morning. Today, I will present a talk that has two things in its title that a priori do not seem to be very close. One is the inflaton, that usually concerns physics of the early universe. The other part in the title concerns the relativistic heavy ion collider. This is a laboratory experiment, and actually the typical energies for these two are vastly apart from each other. So if you ask me as a theorist, what do these things have in common? One first naive answer would be, both of them are formulated as initial value problems. So an initial value problem, what you have is, you have at a given finite instant of time, you have a specific state that may be a pure state, or that may be described by some density matrix, and then you ask the question of what's next. So you ask the question about the time evolution, and you're interested in the state, the properties of the state, at each single instant of time. This is a question that cosmologists are very used to. Cosmology is time evolution, and a prominent example is, for instance, you try from these high precision measurements of the cosmic microwave background, you try to calculate backwards in time and make strong statements about striking things like inflation in the early universe. Going to collider experiments, that used to be quite different. Standard collider experiments usually asked you to calculate transition matrix elements between asymptotic states. But you never really asked the question, what happened in detail at this instant of time when the collision happened? But you didn't want to have a resolution of the time evolution. And exactly this perspective changed radically with the advent of heavy ion collision experiments. Here's an example of a collision experiment at RIC, Brookhaven National Lab. And what happened here is two gold nuclei were colliding with each other almost at the speed of light, and out come thousands of particles, which are here indicated by tracks. Now, what we would like to do from this is getting what we have in the detector and then calculating backwards in time what happened inside this fireball, what happened earlier. We want to have a resolution of the time sequence of this collision, and then want to learn about what happened in this fireball according to our notions of a so-called quark-gluon plasma. So if you now take your favorite textbook on quantum field theory, because it is quantum field theory that should be appropriate to describe these things, if you go to your favorite textbook and look for initial value problems, you don't find any answer usually. The best that can happen to you is that they offer you some more or less phenomenological Boltzmann equation, which you may want to use or not. And the reason why that is the case is partially also due to the fact that initial value problems in quantum field theory are tough mathematical problems. If you want to, for instance, take a very simple example, take a very simple field theory, scalar field, weak coupling, you want to evolve a given state or density matrix in time. If you would use your standard perturbative textbook methods, you would fail completely. It would just blow up immediately, or after a short time. And you need at least very specific resummation schemes, even in the presence of weak couplings, to go to late times. There has been considerable progress in understanding non-equilibrium quantum fields in the community of cosmology, early universe cosmology, and also in the community of particle physics related to collision experiments of heavy nuclei. And it can be very fruitful to bring these two communities together in a program, and we hope that it triggers solution of open outstanding challenges. So what I want to tell you today is, of course, a bit more than just saying both study initial value problems. I will have, naturally, two parts of the talk. One is about collision experiments of heavy nuclei, And the other one is about the problem of heating the universe after inflation. For both of these sections, I will have more or less the same subtitles. So at least on a qualitative level, I will tell you one and the same story twice. And you will see that in these different areas, we've reached different levels of understanding, and we hope that that is fruitful. What I will be talking about is, I will talk about non-equilibrium instabilities and the prospect of using them to have something like very fast thermalization. This question of fast thermalization then will bring us, or force us, to discuss strongly correlated systems far from equilibrium. I will then try to convince you that the study of these strongly correlated systems far from equilibrium can be best done with the notion of so-called non-thermal fixed points. These are time translation invariant, static solutions, far from equilibrium. What is the most bizarre things about these non-thermal fixed points is you start with a strongly correlated system. All processes are order one, infinite number of these processes. You all sum them up, and at the end of the day, you get an effective weak coupling. And the system becomes, in a sense, very simple. That was a big surprise for me. Let me start with the collision experiments of heavy nuclei. There are quite a number of experiments out there. We had a number of talks concerning the relativistic heavy ion collider at Brookhaven National Lab. We also have currently an LHC program going on. And yes, also the LHC has a heavy ion program. It's related to the Alice detector given here. There's another machine coming up. It takes a couple of years still, but the kickoff meeting or the kickoff start event was already this year or past year. That's the Facility for Antiproton and Ion Research, the FAIR facility in Darmstadt. Now, these machines all have a heavy ion program, and what they do is they consider the collision of heavy nuclei, sketched here by this picture, and they want to study the physics of strong interactions, which is described by quantum chromodynamics. When they study this physics, what they do is they start from a transient, far from equilibrium state. Just think of colliding two nuclei almost with the speed of light. That instant, you have a far from equilibrium initial state. And then asking for the time evolution, asking for this initial value problem in time, is asking for the thermalization process. And the question, whether do you reach thermal equilibrium? Schematically, what you have is you have some initial condition. Just think of some non-thermal initial condition. Here you have a particle number, here you have characteristic energy, and it's peaked somewhere. It's not thermal. You know that if you wait long enough, and if you have enough degrees of freedom, you expect to end up in thermal equilibrium, where you have effectively lost all of the details about the initial conditions. It's just described by a few conserved charges, and you end up with a Bose-Einstein of Fermi Dirac distribution. So the question of thermalization is the question of what happened in between. Are there characteristic timescales for a partial loss of information about the initial conditions? And what are these characteristic timescales? There are two, at least in a sketchy way, there are two main observations that are relevant for this discussion about thermalization coming from experiment. One is an observation that if you measure the particle abundances that you get from colliding to large gold nuclei, for instance, that these produced particles, if you plot the particle ratios of all these produced particles, protons, pions, kaons, and so on, that over orders of magnitude in scale, all of these particles can be fitted a simple statistical model with essentially two fit parameters, the temperature and the chemical potential. And the temperature is of the order of about 10 to the 12 Kelvin or 200 MeV or an inverse Fermi. That's an indication that doesn't tell you the system is really thermal, but at least it's consistent with having thermal equilibrium with a temperature that's indeed expected from lattice calculations of QCD, where you get temperatures of the order of 170 or 200 MeV. Now, this
the temperature profile, I mean, does it really kind of pause, or is it falling very rapidly?
You have a statistical model with a Boltzmann factor, and that's parameterized by a temperature and a chemical potential, and that's it.
This is the late-time temperature. The early-time temperature is
so this is really what you would call a temperature, or people call it a freeze-out temperature, because that's what you have when particles do not change anymore. They can still scatter. So this is
also fit proton-proton.
Yes,
from proton-proton.
That's why I say it's an indication. We have one other main observation in this context. And this observation, where this was on a time scale of about 10 Fermi over C, larger than 10 Fermi over C, so late time, we have one other ingredient that brings us to rather early times, to about 1 Fermi over C. And this is the observation that if you close your eyes and just blindly assume that hydrodynamic descriptions should work, then you get at work to describe what you get into your detector. I will give you an example also afterwards. You get what you want if you assume that hydrodynamic descriptions start at about 1 Fermi over C. So in this respect, think of these hydrodynamic calculations as some messenger that brings us to some early times. Yeah? Hydrodynamics doesn't tell you anything about what happened before. We just ignore this time. And a big chunk of my talk will be just to explain how could it happen that we can use hydrodynamics from this instant of time and what happened before. Often, hydrodynamics is used or is said to be an indication of very early local thermal equilibrium. I will argue that this is not necessarily the case. So, early hydrodynamics. Let me just say here it works, and I won't be able to do justice to all the experimental evidence, and that would also put me off track from this talk. But let me give you a specific example of some result, which gives us a number that I will need later on in the talk. So what are the observables? What do you find in your detector? You do have two of these large nuclei that come almost with the speed of light. Lorentz contraction is about a factor of 200, so you have flat pancakes that collide each other. And now you look here in the transverse plane, and if they're not head-on, if they're not central, then you may have an impact parameter or a centrality that looks like this here, like this almond shape. And what you will find into your detector is the number of particles, n, with some given momentum, and with some angle with respect to your coordinate system here in the transverse plane. Now, the number of produced particles, or the average that flows out of your system, that's the so-called radial flow here. It's just the average. And then the first modulation with respect to this azimuthal angle here, the first modulation, this coefficient of this first modulation, that's called the elliptic flow. Now, here's plotted the elliptic flow as a function of transverse momentum in GeV, and the dots here, this is experiment. What you see also is calculations using hydrodynamics, particularly this solid curve here, that's ideal hydrodynamics. just ideal hydrodynamics. Very simple description. The other curves include corrections due to viscosity. And you see, even for rather small viscosity to entropy ratios, you go far away from the data. So what one can say at this stage is almost ideal hydrodynamics works, but have a look at this momenta. Of course, it doesn't work at very high momenta. So if you say hydrodynamic works, you should have in mind, and we need that afterwards, you should have in mind, hydrodynamics works for low momenta, maybe of order 1 to 2 GeV. That's no surprise. At large momenta, there are almost no particles. They're just suppressed. And of course, you don't have a fluid description there. That's no surprise. And also, don't think this is bad. These are all suppressed. So if you have most of the particles you have at low PT, and if you have a description that gives you 99% of your particles and you leave out 1% or a few percent, you're happy. Yeah? So that is really success.
Sure, could it be that the velocity changes with time? When you would go from ideal to higher viscosity?
That's the result that they give us.
If you put the time dependence of Eden, it doesn't make too much difference. But I don't, he's only waving his hands. I don't think he's
actually wrong. The viscosity doesn't matter because there are no gradients.
So what are the essential assumptions for ideal fluid hydrodynamics? And remember, I'm concentrating here on ideal fluid hydrodynamics. It's a particularly simple case. What you need for ideal fluid hydrodynamics is just the conservation of the energy momentum tensor, d mu, t mu, nu equals zero, and an equation of state. Five equations. That's not much. So let's go for the first ingredient, an equation of state. People often say, well, you need some local thermal equilibrium to have a fixed relation between pressure and energy density. The ratio of pressure and energy density is the equation of state. However, you can easily convince yourself that for relativistic massless particles, and we're almost talking here about relativistic massless particles, almost for any distribution, you get a ratio between pressure and energy density of a third, which is thermal, even though you may have non-thermal distributions. To make this, to illustrate this a bit better. No. That comes in a second. Let me go step by step. First I go for the equation of state, and then I ask whether it will be isotropic. So suppose you have an isotropic initial condition. Yes. So let me first consider the isotropic case. Let me first consider the isotropic case. And to give you a nice little illustration, and since we don't have this calculation in QCD, let me give you a calculation in a simple model. It's a model that incorporates the two-flavor chiral symmetry of QCD. It's a Yukawa model. It's in 3+1 dimension, and it's based on one over n techniques, so we could take couplings of order 1. It's a quantum calculation, and it's isotropic, the initial condition. Let's ask, what are the characteristic far-from-equilibrium, non-equilibrium time scales you would find in such a model? We studied two initial conditions. One is particle number as a momentum, as a function of momentum that is peaked. It's certainly non-thermal. That's A. The second initial condition, B, looks a bit more thermal. You may call it color glass or something. Yeah, it has a width. So these very different initial conditions, but same initial energy density. They have now an evolution, and here's the occupation number per mode for the fermions in this case. And you see here, run A and B, they come from very different origins. They wiggle a bit, and then come very close, here for different momenta. This time where they forget most of the details about whether you have condition A or B, this time is very well described by the relaxation time. What do I do by this? What do I mean by this? The relaxation time, you should imagine as a system that's very close to equilibrium. It's in equilibrium just to kick one mode out of equilibrium, and you study how quickly does it relax towards equilibrium. That's the relaxation time. If you then express this in terms of self-energy, it would be the imaginary part of your self-energy. If you just use that, then you find also far from equilibrium, it gives you a rather good estimate of this time. It's the time that you need to forget the details about the initial conditions. that's not the thermalization time in general.
But doesn't that time go down in momentum?
Slightly. You see, these higher momenta come close earlier than these larger, smaller momenta, but it's not terribly depending on that.
In some sense, it's just a kinetic equilibrium.
Well, you may call it as it is. It's the time when you forget the details about the initial conditions. If you have a two-point function, you measure the overlap of a two-point function at some time t with zero, it would be exponentially down to zero at that time.
That's a lie.
It's not?
You still say that that's zero.
That is, of course, something...
That's an empirical fact.
Yes. No, that's something... Yes. So you study far from equilibrium systems, and then you try to relate as much as possible to equilibrium statements, and that what turns out after work. It's not in this 3 plus 1 dimensional system. So you see...
I would believe it falls in relaxation time and equilibrium time.
That's also what you get in linear response. So in linear response, these two timescales collapse to one. And if you do a far from equilibrium simulation, you ask yourself whether one of these timescales you are so used to in equilibrium can be found again out of equilibrium. And yes, it's there. It's the time which you need to forget the details about the initial conditions. It's the time you need when two-point correlators go to zero for unequal time. You see, these two-point correlators going to zero for unequal times, they are not very sensitive to the offset. They always go to zero. And this late time is sensitive to the offset. So it's expected, yeah? But
well,
you have to check it.
Yes.
Yes, see that this is a logarithmic scale. Yeah? So the second part is with linear, this is logarithmic. And of course, if you would be bold and just put in some numbers, say a fermi or 200 MeV, this would be maybe 10 to 30 fermion. Well, it would be much too long. Of course, this is not QCD.
So
this is just...
numbers go down there, the thermalization phase. Where does
the energy flow? This is a coupled system of fermions. You don't want to call them quarks. And scalars, bosons.
I see. So
and I just show you part of it.
So that I would say that the relaxation is the thermalization of these fermions alone.
No, it's a strongly nonlinear system. No, it's not like that. But let me come to the point I want to make, because often people say you need a local thermal equilibrium to have an equation of state. If you now calculate this equation of state, so just calculate your energy momentum tensor, well defined, take the ratio, same time scale here, you see after, yes, some dephasing time or switching on time, how you want to call it, it bops, of course, directly goes to some constant. It's completely blind to the late time scale. Chiral, yes. Massless fermions.
Massless scalars?
No, scalars have a mass.
What?
Scalars have a mass. So if you ask now what is the time for this pre-thermalization or dephasing, it goes as 1 over temperature. So if the temperature is high enough, if you have some high initial temperature, it's very quick. So almost instantly, you can have an equation of state. This is consistent with the early use of hydrodynamics far from equilibrium. But as David also said, that's not the end of the story. Otherwise, it would be much more simple.
So in this area, just understand this. You start with
the
distribution of... And what's happening to the scalars?
So the scalars also have a distribution that is non-thermal. And so they start exchanging energy and momentum. And at the end, you can get an inverse slow parameter and extract the same temperature for the bosons and for the fermions. One go to Fermi-Dirac, and the other one to Bose-Einstein. At the end, I can show you a few more plots to that.
And they achieve
the same time. They achieve it at the same time. It's not that one species thermalizes earlier or just low momenta thermalize earlier. No, it's a highly nonlinear, a complicated phenomenon.
So the equation of state right after the relaxation time is some high frequency rigorous there?
Well, you see, there's a lot happening here. I don't want to say you don't... Yes, but that's the characteristic timescale of this. So there's something happening here. We never resolved it, what it is. It's practically constant concerning.
If you start from exactly thermal initial condition, then of course that would be constant and nothing happens.
So that then it doesn't relax after relaxation time, but only at this, I mean, these don't relax to that thermal initial state. I mean, they don't join together, and we said that at the very end of
So if you're close to thermal equilibrium, these two timescales collapse to one. And then, of course, you just relax back to thermal equilibrium.
So that this relaxation time then cannot be seen. So in some degree, it depends on initial condition.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's defined in terms of initial
Yes. Another important subject is isotropy. Of course, if we start with an isotropic equation of state, that would be simple, but in a realistic heavy ion collision, we have good reasons to believe that the stress tensor is not of this diagonal form initially. So what we have in a heavy ion collision, if you have these two pancakes colliding with each other, they almost go through, they leave behind some region where the energy density is deposited, and if you just look at this slice here, say mid-rapidity, and you wait a bit, then you find that all the particles with longitudinal manta just leave this zone and you end up with only particle in the transverse plane. So initially, if you would just look at this slice, the contributions to the energy momentum tensor in the transverse plane would be much harder, much larger than the one in the longitudinal plane if it were just that we could include scattering, two scattering, more complicated things. Then what would we find is that the isotropization time is practically given by the relaxation time. If you would then go to weak coupling QCD near equilibrium, you can even estimate this. It would be 1 over g to the fourth t, where g is the small gauge coupling. If there were only scatterings, this would be the end of the story. It would take a long time to get relaxation and isotropization, and it would be a long time to be able to get an isotropic stress tensor. However, that's not the end of the story. There are processes that are parametrically much faster than any scattering, so-called non-equilibrium instabilities, or in this context, plasma instabilities. They lead to an exponential growth of these contributions to the energy momentum tensor in the longitudinal
direction.
That's Mr. Weibel, and he studied electromagnetic plasmas. I will come to that in a second. If you then study what is the time scale of this exponential growth, so what is the inverse rate that gives you a time scale, if you again to do weak coupling analysis, you would find it's of order 1 over gt. So if g is small, this time scale can be much faster than this one. So what it comes down to, and this is the punchline here, if you want to understand the early use of hydrodynamics, it means understanding fast isotropization due to plasma instabilities. So it's a clear, crisp question. Can we understand from the fastest known process the isotropization of the stress tensor within a Fermi?
How do the experimental values match in which these two?
Well, I didn't give you experimental values. I come to what time scales we get.
Scale a model of the restriction?
I will come to that. Yeah? Let me not say it here.
You don't have that.
No, but you have something else that's similar. That's the point of my talk. So they're kind of, they're a whole class of possible instabilities, spinodal, parametric, plasma. Let me give you just these original viable type instabilities. I mean, there are many. This is one example. I will give you another example afterwards. Just think of some fluctuating current, a current that goes in some direction. And if you have this current, you just take the right-hand rule, you will find this current produces a magnetic field. If you then look at some of, you know, charged particles flying around here, say charged particle flying somewhat next to the stream with a velocity here in this direction of the current, just take Lorentz force, it will be sucked into the stream. This again makes a larger magnetic field, this sucks more particles. It's a runaway solution. It's a typical instability. And it's the question whether we can achieve fast isotropization or can we speed up even thermalization due to instabilities. There have been a vast number by now of investigations to this point. And let me give you an idea of where we are currently. What are the characteristic timescales we get from studying QCD plasma instabilities? There are two formulations. Both of these formulations, I think one can say, neglect quantum corrections. So that will be one of the deficiencies here. And I will then come to the other part of my talk where we are able to include quantum corrections. One is using classical gauge fields at low momenta, hard particles, classical particles at high momenta. The other one is saying, I don't want to make a separation of scales, I just use fields. They're more or less equivalent, apart from the fact that here you have some nicer properties. It's just a question of what you study. But in principle, they should be equivalent to this stage. What do we get from that? If you look here for the result of the gauge potential at some time t, some momentum normalized, as a function of time in units of the energy density to the fourth root, then you find, this is a log plot, at some given momentum, that these fluctuations grow exponentially. If you have on a log plot a straight line, it's an exponential. You also find that at some higher momenta, this was low momentum, at some higher momenta, the growth rate is less. However, at some point, the system changes, and these first slowly growing modes catch up. Yeah? You see a primary phase and a secondary phase where you have larger growth rates. However, there are some poor guys at even higher momenta. They start out very late. Well, they try to speed up, but they quite don't make it. They're left behind. These will be very important later. If you then ask, what is the characteristic growth rate here in units of this energy density? These are the primaries. They're large at small momenta, smaller at high momenta, and the secondaries grow with momentum, as you can see here.
What's the sphere that separates the ones that catch up and the ones that don't?
I explain this in detail in a simpler model. We did this also in QCD, but I don't do it here, okay? It comes. Okay? I will explain it in detail, but using the cosmological side, which is simpler. But I can also show it for QCD. I don't have the time to do all this here, but it will come. You will get an answer to it. If you then ask, what is the characteristic timescale we get from this growth? And you have to plug in numbers. So one, I mean, not too unreasonable number that you may get for Rick is an energy density of 30 GeV per Fermi cube. Then the maximal growth rate is about a Fermi. Now you may be optimistic and say, wow, that's at least in the right ballpark. But of course, depending...
What is the maximal growth rate in terms of your
picture? This here.
Not the actually faster growth.
No, it's a primary. You see, the secondaries don't really help. The secondaries help these slow guys in the beginning to catch up. But this is the one that should be used to estimate the time, of course. But you may not be too happy with one Fermi because it's just the growth rate. So if you start out with a small amplitude, you may need a number of E-foldings. So yes, it could work, but it would be better to have, say, 0.1. Is that possible? No. The answer is, if you want to get 0.1, you have to go to 300 TeV per Fermi cube. That's not Rick. So how far do we get with one Fermi over C? Let's look for some physical observables. If you finally want to talk about the energy momentum tensor, here we take the energy momentum tensor for the spatial parts. It's time and space dependent. We Fourier transform with respect to space. And we calculate the longitudinal pressure and the transverse pressure. Initially, the longitudinal pressure is small. So the ratio starts small. And if they go to 1, they're isotropic. What you see here is that the low momentum modes on similar time scales than what I showed you before isotropize rather quickly. And even these somewhat slow guys, yes, with these secondaries, they speed up and make it. However, there are these poor guys that are left behind. They never become isotropic on short time scales.
You may initial condition which sets them different, or
no?
So, what's the difference between these three?
Momentum.
The momentum is okay.
You may then ask a rough question: can we get at least, say, half of the transverse pressure also in the longitudinal direction, or 60%? Yeah, we could work with that. So, for what range of momenta do you get, say, at least roughly the same pressure? You plug in numbers and you find, well, you get a range of momenta up to about a GeV that is isotropic, and the rest is not.
I'm sorry, momenta in what direction? What exactly do you mean by momenta? Because
it's transverse momentum.
Oh, it's transverse momentum.
Yes. You have the transverse plane and it's longitudinal momentum. It's in this direction, it's
and
in the beam direction.
Three different cases here.
Yes, this is for different momentum. P equals 0.4, 0.8, and 3.5 in units of the energy density. So this, you could be somewhat optimistic about this. We know that hydrodynamics just needs isotropization in low momentum range. What the problem is here first is the isotropization time of the high momentum mode is consistent with infinity. And I will come to that puzzle. Yes. So they don't really isotropize. I mean, infinity means you just make the lattice larger and takes longer and longer. Yeah? And what is even worse, it's classical simulation. So higher momenta are not suppressed by an exponential, and you always find that your energy momentum tensor is dominated by these guys. So it's not enough to do a classical simulation. It's probably very good for low momenta because you have very high occupation numbers there, but there must be a momentum scale when this description breaks down. So is this enough for hydro? That's not clear. Is there an important role of quantum corrections for lower occupied modes at higher momenta? Not clear. Important question. And let me also say something to this, that the isotropization time of these poor higher momenta go to infinity. What do you find if you go to later times? And I stole this plot from Mike Strickland. It was the nicest I could find. It's a hard loop setup that's very similar. It has differences, of course. This is the occupation number here as a function of momentum. And you see here these lines as simulation time increases. And what you find is that instead of thermalizing, you approach here a scale invariant spectrum that's not thermal. Classical thermal would be 1 over k. This is 1 over k squared. And you have here occupation numbers that go with 1 over self-coupling squared. So that's the densest system you can think of. All processes are order 1. It's strongly correlated. But seems to be scale invariant. It has a power law spectrum. And I will, as I said in the introduction, I will just put here the tantalizing question whether for this strongly correlated system, could it be that we find an effective recoupling description? I don't have it for QCD, but I want to go over now to the second part of my talk. I want to tell this more or less, or at least qualitatively, the same story in cosmology when we discuss the heating of the universe. You will find very much similarities. There are important differences, but interesting similarities. And the nice thing is, there we have the luxury that we can do a quantum calculation. Yeah? Because those, at least the simplest models you use in this cosmological context, are just scalar field theories. And there we know how to do the non-equilibrium quantum evolution. So let me come to the second part. What is the problem? After the Big Bang, we think we have a period of time, the so-called inflationary period, where you have an almost exponential increase of the scale factor of the universe. So just very large growth in volume. And at the end of this growth, Of course, since the standard hot Big Bang cosmology is so successful, we have to connect to the standard hot Big Bang cosmology. What is happening when you have such a growth? Now, suppose you have some stuff down here before the growth, some energy density of matter, radiation. Now, matter and radiation dilute very quickly, one with 1 over the A cubed scale factor, the other one even a power more. So at the end of the day, if you're here, no matter what you started with, you don't have matter and you don't have radiation. So there's an enormous heating after inflation to get the hot Big Bang picture back. How can we achieve this? There have been a number, I mean, there's a whole plethora of possible things here. Let me pick one, and I pick here parametric resonance. I could have also used tachyonic preheating. Believe me, the pictures would look practically the same. All the analysis would be the same. So I pick one, and I pick a very simple one. I think of chaotic inflation. That may not be your favorite model, I know, but it's enough for our purposes. Think of a scalar lambda phi to the fourth inflaton. It interacts. It's a quantum field. It has an expectation value. You can also calculate the two-point function, which would be the anti-commutator. And then after inflation, the inflaton finds itself displaced from its ground state, and it starts rolling down its potential. It happily oscillates, interacts with, in particular, with its own quantum fluctuations. And bang, suddenly you find that fluctuations grow exponentially. That's the resonance catastrophe. There's no deep physics in here. You can just take a classical oscillator example, and it's even mathematically exact at early times, this simple example. Just think of a pendulum. And this pendulum, whenever it's at its lowest point, you give it a kick, so you change the length of your... Well, it happens very quickly, you see. You change the length of your pendulum, and there it is. It has an instability and it grows. And if you just do the mapping, this frequency of kicking, that's the field. It kicks. And the amplitude is just the fluctuation. And believe me, for very early times, that's the picture. Now let's do it in the quantum theory. We can calculate there, and we did here an n equals 4 component inflaton, so an n component inflaton. The results will be for n equals 4, it's not very important. It has a phi to the fourth interaction, and if you look, for instance, for energy, this is energy as a function of time, here in units of the initial amplitude, it's a rescaled, with square root of the coupling rescaled amplitude. And what you see is, initially, this is the energy stored in the inflaton field. Initially, all the energy is stored in the inflaton. And then at some point, there is this bang, this exponential decrease of energy stored in the inflaton. It slightly overshoots at the time when the fluctuations, the energy stored in the fluctuations, which likewise grow, when they're roughly equal, you have a highly nonlinear evolution, but finally fluctuations take over. If you then look for your definition of your favorite particle number, that's not very important, take occupation number as a function of time and momentum, here as a function of time, four different momenta. It's on a log plot, so again, if you see a straight line, it's exponential. You see primary growth. You see also some guys that are slower growing at some other momenta which catch up. And if you go to very high momenta, you see these poor guys that grow with multiples of this primary growth rate, but they don't quite make it and are left behind. So it's very, at least superficially, very similar to what we have seen also before. And what I want to point out to you is the following. There's first this fast evolution. It's our hope that instabilities do something very fast, and they do. But then suddenly, the system is slow.
This instability is purely in the scalar sector, not in...
Yes, purely in the scalar sector. I don't want to explain all this to you, but it should give you an impression that we really can calculate everything in great detail, even analytically to a large extent. We can calculate the growth rates, we can calculate the times, and all in a quantum description. That's very luxurious. one over n expansion to next to leading order. But let me give a few things that I want to convey to you. There's this fast growth. First, there is a classical linear growth initially. So you start at some initial time. Your fluctuations of order one, your field is large parametrically in the coupling if the coupling is small. You start growing exponentially, and if you have a small coupling, initially fluctuation effects coming from these type of loops, they all come with couplings, they are suppressed. But if you grow exponentially, you will have a time where the fluctuations become parametrically of 1 over some power of the self-coupling. So for instance, 1 over square root of lambda. If you have in these loops the propagators f running around, and they're 1 over square root of lambda, and you have here the fields coming with 1 over square root of lambda, and you have 2 powers of lambda from the vertices, you finally see, oh, at this time, this diagram is order 1. So it matters. You can go to the next diagram. What is the time when this becomes of order 1? And you find that's when the fluctuation is of order 1 over lambda 2 to the 2/3. And you can also write down the time when this happens. So this is the nonlinear regime, where you have still perturbation theory in the sense that there is a finite number of processes. For instance, in the Boltzmann description, this diagram would be just 2 to 2 scattering. So you find, scattering becomes important once occupation numbers grow, of course. And there's a regime where it's nonlinear but perturbative. But there is an end, and then it becomes non-perturbative.
And perturbative in what sense?
That you have a finite number of diagrams to take into account. At some point, and that's the case what this buzzword saturation is about, at some point these fluctuations are of 1 over the self-coupling, then you can convince yourself that any diagram you can write down is of order 1. So the probability of 2 particles finding each other is the same as 1,000 particles finding each other or 1,000,000 particles finding each other. It's the strongest, it's a non-perturbative dense system, very complicated. What happens? You have 1 over lambda. This 1 over lambda from the propagators always eats up the lambdas from the vertices. The lambda drops out. It's universal. It's independent of the details of your model. That's very nice. And that's also what is very helpful when we make the following discussion. All processes are of order 1. And now comes this great surprise. You put together, you know, an infinite number of order 1 processes. And at the end of the day, what you find, there is an effective weak coupling.
Why do you have weak coupling?
I come to this. This I have to explain, yes. This is just, you know, saying it again.
It's larger and it's enabling you to do this, is that right?
Yes. It's next to leading order in 1 over n. So it's, in a sense, this type of diagrams also, I didn't show you the diagrams with field insertions. You also have to do that. There's a background field. No. It's, yes. So in principle, the coupling drops out here. It doesn't matter what coupling you take if it's not too large. The 1 over n is not the expansion parameter. This is what we always use. I mean, and what you would expect is that all these processes are of order 1. But I will show you that you find that one loop is enough with, I'll show you in a second what I mean by weak coupling, because it will take too much time to make it before. In understanding what I want to describe in the following, it's a good thing to understand the following concept, the concept of so-called non-thermal fixed points. That's a big word for something very simple. It's the question, are there time translation invariant solutions of your evolution equations that are non-thermal? We all agree, no. There can be only one time translation invariant solution in a closed system. The Edge theorem tells us it must be thermal equilibrium, it's unique. Nevertheless, it could be that if you go to a classical world where you don't have quantum corrections, that there is more than one solution. And that is what I want to tell you in a moment. I want to tell you that this far from equilibrium evolution, this very slow one, we can understand by studying the properties of non-thermal fixed points of the corresponding classical statistical theory. That doesn't mean that you reach this fixed point. What does it mean? Here's a cartoon. Think of this space of correlation functions, you know, all 1-point, 2-point, 3-point functions. You have a hypersurface that gives you the initial conditions. And usually, if you start with some initial condition, you end up in the thermal equilibrium fixed point. However, for some initial conditions, what could happen is that you come close to one of these non-thermal fixed points, and the distance between these arrows indicate constant time difference. And if you stay very long near these approximate fixed points, the system acquires the properties of these non-thermal fixed points, but finally, quantum corrections, of course, will drive you away. And if quantum corrections are small, then these non-thermal fixed points are relevant. Relevant in the sense that they describe
you. What do you mean by a non-thermal fixed point is a fractional?
Suppose. Yes. So take the quantum world, and there you know there cannot be more than one fixed point. The question whether you have solutions or not, let me tell you in a moment, because I can give you an answer to that. You don't find a solution for all momenta, but you find a solution for low momenta, you find a solution for high momenta, which is a fixed point of your classical evolution equation. But you don't find, there's no contradiction to the H theory.
You mean fixed point literally time independent?
Yes.
Because fairly decaying turbulence.
You see, there is an issue here.
It's not.
So what I'm about to say will be only relevant if you could send the cutoff to infinity.
Yeah, sure.
For certain correlators, you can do that. And for those correlators, I will show you, you can do that. But of course, the classical theory is not defined for sending the cutoff to infinity. So you will never find truly in a classical world a fixed point that is not the classical one. But if you could send the cutoff to infinity, I will show you it's a solution.
But is what you're calling this non-thermal fixed point a situation in which you have energy cascading towards shorter and shorter wavelengths?
Yes.
So in that sense, it's stationary, but
yes.
It's not static.
It's stationary, but if you would send the cutoff to infinity, and if you wouldn't have quantum corrections, you would not get away from it.
But
it's
got
something pumping it at the long wavelength.
Right, if something is...
So in these cases, it's the scalar field that pumps at zero momentum. The scalar will obey a power law, all the other fields will obey a power law, and in the sense that you have a power law, you can go to infinite time. Okay? So it's well.
Is this isolated system?
I show you.
No.
This is an isolated system.
But then if energy cascades to shorter scales, it got to be depleted at longer scales. And in fact, that's what happens in free decay and turbulence. Your entire power spectrum goes down.
Let me tell you what are the similarities and what are the differences of this.
You have an input on, right? Which just keeps on
first,
well, that it does eventually.
Yes. So first, let me convince you that the physics is classical. Yeah? That's non-trivial. Classical statistical simulations have been done by many people. Yeah, we have several in the audience, and Juan García Bellido, for instance, also does it for gauge fields. Yeah, so there is a whole bunch. I couldn't put all the literature here. So I just took some of the first guys, as Shirzi Klemnikov, for instance. And you can also do now, in a quantum theory, these calculations. And you can check that the quantum theory indeed would thermalize, for instance, to a Bose-Einstein distribution. This plotted is the fluctuation as a function of momenta, here for different snapshots of time. This is the linear, nonlinear regime, non-perturbative regime. The solid line here is the simulation. You just take your classical field equation, you simulate it many times, you sample over initial conditions, and you get your correlators. It's exact in a classical sense. The other line here is the quantum calculation at next to leading order and 1 over n. And yeah, you see some differences here, but appreciate that these are very different calculations. One is these many, many runs on a lattice. The other one is an analytic equation for one correlation function, and you solve it once. So even to find out that the discretization errors are the same is a task, yeah, and to get the same initial condition. So the agreement.
So my question is more of are you saying that this is a disagreement, is a feature of particle n or a feature of quantum?
Since n is 4, and this is not large n in the sense that next to leading order corrections don't matter, next to leading order corrections are absolutely important here. Leading order would just give you a flat time evolution. So I'm saying.
To be sure, leading order is not so interesting because it's a non-interaction positive theory and stuff. So we have to go beyond that, but it's still
yes,
weakly classical. So is this evidence that one of our expansions are indeed classical like?
No.
Or is it
so we did with this calculation that's the point I come to. We did with this setup, for instance, studies for stabilization to a Bose-Einstein distribution. So you really get Bose-Einstein at next to leading order in 1 over n. And I think if it's a clear answer, it has quantum corrections and the relevant one that lead you to Bose-Einstein. So we have no reason whatsoever to believe that this is an artifact of 1 over n. So. Yes, but yeah. But let me continue because otherwise I run into the problem. So we see an amazing agreement even in this non-perturbative regime here, and even these small features here are resolved. On the one hand, this hand side, this tells you, okay, there's an accurate non-perturbative description of 2pi 1 over n. It's accurate. But on the other side, it also tells you quantum corrections are not very important. And we did many times stabilization studies. We know that for other initial conditions, quantum corrections are important, typically. What I want to put your attention to is, there's no surprise that you don't have quantum corrections here. But this is the anticommutator. This is occupation number. Go down here. The occupation number is very, very small. And there is no sign of any relevant quantum correction there. And of course, as Lev was saying, all is related to the fact that in these cosmological models, you have weak coupling physics. You know, it's the coupling that's so weak. That makes it. But nevertheless, it is striking. Yeah? You would not expect that quantum corrections don't show up at these high occupation numbers. It was a big surprise. And to explain what I want to explain in the following. What I want to argue is you have to wait very long. Yes, of course. This is a quantum world. You better ask to. Yes, and cosmology is lasting forever in a sense. To explain this in a bit more detail, I have to give you now a very few things of quantum field theory out of equilibrium, but not much. Think of the propagator. It's the two-point function. It can always be decomposed identically in an anticommutator and a commutator if you have bosons, or the other way around if you have fermions. The anticommutator, if you would think of a free field theory, it's just particle number. The anticommutator tells you how often is a state populated. The commutator is just a spectral function. This tells you what states are available. So how often are they occupied? What states are available? The tremendous simplification you have in equilibrium or vacuum is that there is a relation between these two, the fluctuation-dissipation relation. It's much simpler. Out of equilibrium, you don't have, in general, a relation between commutator and anticommutator, and you need separate equations for these two guys. Nevertheless, this is a spectral function. It's always order one. It's just sum over the whole spectrum. It's just one. This can be large. Okay? Then you have evolution equations for these guys. I wrote down here just the exact Schwinger-Dyson equations for the F and the rho. And you can parameterize their interactions by self-energies. I didn't tell you so far what these self-energies are. There are also these F components and rho components, similar to commutator and anticommutator. What means classical now? Let me give you an example, a simple example. This is not 1 over n to next to leading order. This is just one loop or two loop here. This is the quantum diagram, setting sum diagram. You do it in a quantum theory, the calculation, and you find you have three propagator lines, so F, F, F. But you don't have just F, 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 you have also F, rho, rho in a quantum theory. Then you do the very same calculation starting from your classical field equations. So you never heard about quantum correction. Then the rho is the Poisson bracket, and so on. There's a clean mapping to the classical world. You have the same topologies, of course. You have classical statistical fluctuations, same topologies, but if you compare these two, you see that the difference between quantum and classical is just these red terms. So if you cross out these terms, you move from the quantum description to the classical one. And that's very intuitive. F was the occupation number, rho was order one, so whenever you have large occupation numbers, this guy is irrelevant. So I use this setup now to study whether there are non-thermal fixed points. So are there time and space in translation invariant solutions? And if you just go to your equations of motions, this condition to find time and space translation invariant solutions just means that the self energies, sigma rho, sigma f, is zero. You may think of this as a gain and a loss term in Boltzmann equation, but this is quantum field theory. But it's very similar. Yeah? Usually you have some equilibrium that gives you zero. What I will now do is I neglect the quantum corrections. I don't throw away the topologies. Yeah? But I neglect quantum corrections. And I call this J3 and J4 for obvious reasons in a moment. I give these expressions here. At next to leading order in 1 over n, what you get is a one-loop type contribution with two external fields and a two-loop type contribution with a correction factor here. That's not very relevant. And all these infinite resummation you can put into this blob, which you may call an effective coupling. So if this effective coupling would be 1, you would just have what you would expect from perturbation theory. Yeah, it would be just one loop and two loop corrections. If this would be 1, of course, you would have a strong coupling. You would be amazed to see that all the rest is 0. And you saw how precise is it.
What if you wouldn't have large occupation number? Then you would have to...
Yeah, then it doesn't have this very simple form, you know, then you have this plus 1/2 always.
I'm a little bit puzzled that initially when you wouldn't have large occupation number, but still you had a very good agreement.
Mm. That has to do that finally for the correlators what matters is a sum of all modes, but analytically it doesn't help you. So this nice feature that I showed you is just when you do, but of course it's not very important for high occupation number. So this blob that I showed you, I just made a thick black dot. You can resolve this. This is such a coupling here. It has, if you make it diagrammatically, this would be the effective coupling. So do it iteratively. Plug it in here, and then you see you sum all these bubbles to infinite order. Yeah? It's, you know the structure from 1 over n. This coupling can also be, if it's translation invariant, can also be in Fourier space written down. It's just the original coupling divided by 1 plus the one-loop retarded self-energy squared. The one-loop retarded self-energy here is F times the retarded propagator, standard. Now we go to the non-perturbative regime and calculate this coupling. This is the coupling as a function of momenta here for different frequency. Remember, we have frequency and three momentum. So first of all, go to large momentum. Large, well, what means large? Of order 1. Yeah? You find that this coupling goes to 1. So for momenta of order 1, your system, where all processes were of order 1, boils down to a description that just includes one and two loop. It's practically exact. But there's even more. If you then go to low momenta, even this one and two loop contribution become very small.
It screens itself in a way, because this is some kind of screening.
I will show you in a moment. Of course, it's fluctuation, yes, that makes this active coupling that has for large momentum range practically no dependence of momenta. And also, if you take, for instance, some small frequency that's non-zero, you also find that the coupling is rather constant. So even for low momenta, if the frequency acts as an infrared cutoff, you find that your system, this very strongly correlated system with 1 over self-coupling occupation numbers, it's practically just 1 and 2. You could also use a Boltzmann equation. Yeah? And this, at these high densities, it's a surprise. What you also find is if you go to lower frequencies and lower momenta, it's not Boltzmann. It's nevertheless very weakly coupled, so you expect it to be very slow.
Are they still in classical regime, or?
It's all classical.
They're all in classical.
You can go on. Now, what is the nature of these solutions? This was the simulation result. This was a quantum calculation result that I showed you there. Let's go on analytically. We want to try and find solutions that are scale invariant, that have no scale. So we scale all the relevant infrared cutoffs you have in your theory with S, and then you get, for instance, for your two-point function, the anticommutator, you may get an anomalous scaling exponent from the occupation number. The spectral function is always order one, doesn't receive an anomalous occupation exponent from the occupation number. There may be a small anomalous dimension from quantum correction, but it's probably zero here. And we also look for scaling solutions for this effective coupling. If you look for this retarded self-energy, just plug this in and you find that it scales also with the exponent alpha. So since the lambda effective was 1 over 1 plus the retarded self-energy, there will be two regimes. There will be one regime where the retarded self-energy is small, it's in the UV, and there will be one regime in the infrared where the retarded self-energy is large. Just think of putting here SP equals 1. Then you would get pi r goes as 1 over p to the alpha. So for small momenta, it's large. If alpha is positive, yes, it is. First solution, and I won't have the time to go through all of this, but it's very straightforward. You just look for the scaling properties, you identify what is the relevant contribution, and you then look for the zeros. Why can we do that? We can do that by generalized Sakharov transformations. It's very similar to his original proposal for weak turbulence. This is not weak turbulence, but you can find the relevant mappings of your contributions under the integral.
If you set gamma to zero, it is kind of weak turbulence.
Yes, in a sense. I will show you in a second. And then we find the solutions alpha equals 1. That's just classical thermal equilibrium. And the non-trivial solution 3/2. Then we go to the infrared. Will be not weak turbulence. We find the solution, this would be just zero temperature, this would be again thermal, and then there are these amazingly large exponents, alpha equals 4 and 5. So we found several non-thermal fixed points of the evolution equations. We didn't find from this analytical study which of them will be the relevant one. It depends on the initial conditions. So what does parametric resonance do? If we start with parametric resonance and we do the simulation of the particle number as a function of momentum here to very late times, then we find in the UV, I mean UV meaning momentum of order 1 here, don't think this is very high, we find that as you go on in time, the curve starts to get, it just smooths on to this straight line. So this is a fit, and this is a fit. The rest is calculation. So these dotted lines is at 400, 1,000, 3,000, and 8,000 in these units of the initial field amplitude. And you see that As you go on in time, this UV sector just goes on and tries to get to this line, and you find that for high momenta, you get alpha equals 3/2 to very good accuracy. For low momenta, I think it's pretty convincing that you get -4. In the very infrared, it may take a bit more time. There is this region where you have, you know, either the retarded self-energy is larger than 1 or smaller than 1. So the one-loop retarded self-energy sets the scale of where you have the transition between these two regimes. But I think it's very convincing that the classical evolution can be nicely characterized by these non-thermal fixed points. It's remarkable that at rather low momenta, I mean, what I call UV is a momenta of order 1, where you still think you have all these processes of order 1 with occupation numbers parametrically as 1 over lambda. A priori, there's no reason to believe a Boltzmann equation. But it turns out to be practically exact. And you find from previous studies, for instance from Hishan Kotchev, if you take a Boltzmann equation with three-leg interaction, yes, there's this 3/2 fixed point that you recover. It just extends to rather low momenta, but finally, at very low momenta, this perturbative picture becomes incorrect. The theory becomes even more weakly coupled. The effective coupling goes with momentum to the 2 alpha, so it would be momentum to the 8. So in the infrared, it's practically free, and you see these non-thermal fixed point in the infrared coming up. So let me try to line up here. Yeah, I started out with QCD. I showed you that relevant physics there leads to exponential growth. You found this primary, secondary. Then we went to the inflaton dynamics, much more simple and agreeable there. It's less rich, the scalar field dynamic, but at least on a superficial level, you find the same features. You understand very nicely why there are these secondaries. It's just these fluctuation effects, all these diagrams coming in, giving you, you know, multiples of the original growth rate here for the weakly coupled theory. Then we saw it goes over to a very slow evolution in both cases. In classical QCD, we found, yes, there is this power law. Unfortunately, we never really went here to the infrared, yeah, to the deep infrared. We were able to do it for the scalar case, and we could show that this far from equilibrium evolution is very well characterized by non-thermal fixed point solutions in the UV and in the infrared. And in particular, it would be, of course, tantalizing to find a way how to describe analytically this regime in terms of, say, 1 and 2 loop diagrams. Because a priori, you think that all processes are of order 1. I didn't solve that. I just say there is a theory. It's admittedly much more simple. There you find that. So you can make now, and this will be also my conclusions, you can make now the following statements. For inflaton physics, and people in the field know it, the original hope that instabilities lead to fast stabilization is, of course, not correct. Yeah, it takes, if you like, infinitely long, but of course these are simple models, weakly coupled models. You may always put some stronger coupled particles in there and then you can resolve this problem. Yeah, it's not a problem in itself, but just the instability physics will not help. There is a slight you can also see it a bit differently. Of course, you produce things like pressure very quickly. And you do have things like an equation of state very quickly. So you may also use at these very early times an effective equation of state. We even derived an effective temperature that worked very nicely. And do as if you have thermal physics for certain quantities. But you have to be very careful and know what you're doing if you want to use thermal physics far from equilibrium after the end of an instability. So some of the quantities really pre-thermalize in this respect. We have seen on this luxurious, nice example where we could do quantum corrections and all analytically, that this late-time physics, it is non-perturbative, but it's characterized by an effective recoupling, which is by itself, I think, a striking thing. It's certainly unstable with respect to quantum corrections, and the reason why these fixed points with these remarkable properties were relevant is just that we had a small coupling. If we would crank up in the scalar models the coupling, we would first destroy the instability. So certainly, if you have couplings that are large, scattering plays an important role. Yeah? But if you have models that have, say, you know, very flat direction with small couplings, then you run into the problem that quantum corrections don't drive you away from these fixed points and you get stuck. You just get a static system. In QCD, well, so far we just have the classical evolution available. It's a pity, but there's progress going on. We found that there is a characteristic time scale for plasma instabilities of about a Fermi over C. That's not too great, but it's not too bad. We have a bottom-up isotropization in the sense that low momenta isotropize first, and for reasonable energy densities, we get to about a GeV. And if you're very optimistic, you may say this tells us about, you know, the success of hydro, but you can also take the pessimistic viewpoint there and say this is not enough for hydro. What is, I think, the biggest problem here is that no isotropization is found for these dominant, in a classical theory, UV momenta. So we, to be sure, we need to incorporate quantum corrections. Nevertheless, suppose you take these classical simulations, and we believe these simulations at low momenta, even though, I mean, we don't think that these very high occupied low momenta are affected by quantum corrections. Can this slow late-time behavior be understood in these terms of non-thermal fixed points? Can we find in QCD an effective recoupling that explains why it's so slow? That would be great. There's more to it. Suppose you have now these non-thermal fixed points. It's a static solution. You can now linearize around it. You can talk about things, or you may want to think about things like viscosity. Usually you think about thermal equilibrium, and then you deviate from it and you think about relaxation times, you know, quantities that characterize the deviation from it. The same one could now do with these non-thermal fixed points. Yeah? You can also linearize around that and study the system. It would tell you a lot. So there's lots of things to do, and thanks for your patience.
Can I just ask a question about the experimental evidence for isotropization? So your main evidence there was the agreement of data with analysis with hydrogen. But to turn that into a quantitative statement, you'd have to have a model of a non-isotropic flow.
To my knowledge, not. I think it was a great achievement that Paul showed us this simulation with non-zero viscosity. Yeah? To say viscosity is small, we first have to see what happens if you plug it in. Is it really small? And yes, completely agree. One now has to go on and do that analysis that hasn't been done with viscosity. We've already. It's remarkable work.
One comment on that is that Paul's latest studies, which I'll show tomorrow, now varies this isotropization time from 0.5 up to 2 Fermi over C, and all curves lie on top of one another.
But this he said before. We should be, I mean, you find in his publication, he says, his one Fermi is just to make it easy. Yeah.
I mean, they have other dials which they adjust behind the scenes, so he has some freeze-out temperature and some other things.
But this he said in his talk. I mean, and he also writes it. So he says he can easily accommodate for 1 to 2 Fermi.
But tomorrow I'll talk about using high-energy dileptons to try to fix and tau isotropization. So try to find some other way.
Okay. I first curious this non-thermal fixed points, do they have any relation to these fixed points I've discussed, you know, at our last meeting here at KITP? Do you ever make a quantitative comparison, or is it completely different?
I thought about it. It has, to my best knowledge, not to do with that. It's a high occupation number fixed point. It's not a fixed point that you get in a system by imposing some truncations in loops.
But if you just look at the practice, because you know when it gets classical.
For instance, one of these
fixed points. And then again, also these higher loops, this old one should disappear. So somehow I would guess, you know, just quantitative, they may be very similar.
I don't think you get scaling solution there for what you did. I looked at it. I'm not sure that I did everything, but I was, of course, inspired also by this, but it's not the same. This is a scaling solution relevant for high occupation numbers. But indeed, I mean, there could be more fixed points out there that help you to understand this far from equilibrium physics in more simple terms. It's really very helpful, this notion of fixed points, which you introduce.
Just to understand, I mean, to be sure that I understand, I mean, this is a fixed point in the sense that you, if you have a source at infrared end of the spectrum which pumps energy, and then you have kind of sink in the ultraviolet, so for example, I mean, you don't have any cutoff, so you can flow forever to ultraviolet, then you have a fixed point. But if you put a cutoff at ultraviolet at some stage, then you reheat it and you will thermalize.
So first of all, that was also why I said, you know, true classical theory is not existing for infinite cutoff.
Yes, but you also need to
solve power meters, you can do it. And there is no, don't think that, I mean, as you know very well, just to, there's no source and sink, it's a closed system, but you have certain parts of your system, like your field that pumps energy in the infrared, and then you have just the modes cascading to the UV. Yeah.
Kai, you can even see in his picture that the spectrum does go down.
Yes.
The one that, where they measured the power loss, it does go down because it propagates to the ultraviolet, and this has to come from somewhere.
Sure.
Yes, of course. Of course. And you also see the power law behavior of the field.
I want to make a comment. People saying about turbulence. Sure, in terms of spectrum, there is similarity to turbulence. If you look at the image, how this field looks like, mm-hmm. within simulation with this scalar field, I mean, scalar dynamics is 5 to 3. It has nothing to do with turbulence.
Where
are you applying? We're applying the profile of the field. Really, the realization of the field, it goes through the
scalar.
So he takes one representative, so one inhomogeneous field, and then looks at the fluctuation.
Yes.
And how is turbulence supposed to look?
I can see. There is a movie. The movie shows.
Yeah, the turbulence I have a lot. How am I supposed to look at the pressure?
No, I just look at the contours of whatever I want to energy density. How it looks like? It looks like a standing peaks, which are increasing with time. They're not moving. They're standing waves. It will initially oscillating. It's very homogeneous. Then it will have to show them. So then it's showing up, and then you'll see how the standing waves are forming and staying there, and there is a dynamic of them there, getting sharper and sharper, going into a mini regime that has nothing to do with the waves on the outside of the region.
And you see the coincidence that we have, this is the perturbative analysis, that was highly non-trivial. That you can get all these order one processes and massage them into something that is becoming nearly exact at the one and two loop level, with a coupling of order one for the UV. I mean, in a perturbative sense, this would not make sense. You would get through the coupling one also higher order corrections. So, in a sense, it's a coincidence that you get the same exponents as you get from a naive, not naive, but weak turbulence analysis, where you would have a small coupling from the outset. And of course, this infrared behavior you don't get at all.
Let me point out, however, if you have gauge fields, you can have, as I showed, some long-wave configurations which resemble very much what you would have in eddies. So they're small curves which would have magnetic field going along those lines, which become bigger and bigger. I don't know whether you would call that turbulence. Simply, it's different from the scalar distribution.
These are limits. So we can really, you can calculate it. You can express it in terms of correlators. It's scale invariant. You may also like the viewpoint. It's more like a second order phase transition. We have exponents. They're not quite non-trivial, but you have large correlation length. It's a picture.
Well, don't explain it.
I think once more may get a remark on this fixed points. The full system has of course no fixed point, even not for the classical CO. We know that.
The quantum corrections drive you away.
Yeah, even the purely classical system would not have the full system, would not have the complete fixed point.
But that's already infinitely long if you put the cutoff larger.
My picture was always that you see these fixed points when you can. When you know the non-fixed point information is only in higher correlation functions, let's say 8-point functions or something like that. If they do not play a major role, then the remaining system goes very, very slowly. Is that not what you're seeing? Because you just see with your effective small coupling that indeed the higher correlation functions do not play a role. Is that not the
case? You see, even where the coupling is 1, I just have 1 to look correct. So there is a regime.
What I mean, this just means that the higher order 1DI functions do not really make a contribution.
They don't make no contribution.
And then it's of course, in these reduced systems, you have 2 fixed points.
I think you certainly have to have some kind of simplicity to have a slow evolution, either small coupling, an effective small coupling that explains why the system is so slow. And yes, in this respect, it resembles that. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a comment. I mean, you stress that you need a small coupling for all this. Maybe I would say more important ingredient is that you have large energy assets. Because at the end, when you enter this classical regime, you have no coupling.
But you see, I can't apply this in terms of coupling. So the initial field is 1 over the square root. So the coupling is small, it's exactly what you say, you have large
energy. No, I agree with that for sure. So, the initial field being 1.
I see your point. I could also make the coupling constant and just increase the field value. Mm-hmm. It's true.
You could have lambda is 1 and have the whole picture just by putting the level of energy.
Right.
And at the end, when you enter this classical regime, the coupling is 2, as you said. It's classical.
Okay.